And as cruel and harsh as it was, at least it wasn't the Liam the League would have turned out, a violent, unforgiving reflection of how they thought the world should be.
I'm not happy about this.
I know, I whispered. I leaned across Liam's prone form to wrap my arms around Chubbs's neck. If he was surprised by my burst of affection, he didn't show it. Instead, he patted me gently on the back before turning to finish his work with Vida.
You make me as crazy as a bag of cats, but if anything happens to you, I'm going to lose it. Are you sure? Are you 100% positive you know what you're doing?
Yeah, I said.
Unfortunately.
I've had training, remember?
His mouth twisted into a humorless smile. And to think, when we found you...
Chubbs didn't have to finish. I knew what I'd been when I'd found them. A terrified splinter of a girl who had been shattered a long time ago. I had nothing, and no one, and no real place to go. Maybe I was still broken, and would always be. But now, at least, I was piecing myself back together, lining up one jagged edge at a time. 19. We only waited long enough for the sun to go down before heading out. The quick sunset was one of the few blessings of a rapidly approaching winter. I tried to calculate, in a distracted kind of way, exactly how much time had passed since I set off looking for Liam. 2 weeks, if even? It was December. I remembered the digital display in the train station in Rhode Island. I counted back.
We missed your birthday.
We were hovering at the back of the pack, drifting there almost naturally while Olivia and Brett had taken charge in front. Whatever Springsteen song Jude had been humming under his breath was bottled back up, mid-note.
What?
It was last week, I said, reaching out to steady him as he jumped over a fallen tree. Today's December 18th.
Really?
Jude crossed his arms over his chest and began to rub them.
Feels like it, I guess.
15, I said with a low whistle.
You're getting up there in years, old man.
I started to unwind the wool scarf from around my neck, but he waved it away and marched on, his EMT jacket crinkling as he moved. For such a large group, we were moving quietly through the undergrowth, snapping a few twigs here and there, breaking through pockets of ice. We were still too deep into what Brett had called the Cheatham Wildlife Management Area to attract much attention anyway.
Oh, you found it?
I asked when I caught the flash of silver gripped in Jude's palm. Jude held it out for me to see. It was a circular, nearly flat disc. The silver coating glinted in the single strand of moonlight that cut through the tree branches. I plucked it out of his hand and put the warm metal at the center of my palm. The compass's glass had cracked in two places.
Yeah, he said, taking it back. For a second there...
Never mind.
Never mind?
I repeated in disbelief. What's wrong?
It's just that, for a second, I was really happy I found it, you know? And then I started to think that maybe I shouldn't take it with me.
Because?
Because Albin gave it to me, he said. A few days after I came to HQ, he kept saying how proud he was that I was part of the league, but it's like... Now I don't think I'm so proud of being part of it.
I let out a long sigh, trying to find the right words. Jude only shrugged again and slid the string over his head. The compass disappeared under his jacket, and I thought, that's the difference. That was the fundamental difference between the two of us. Once I woke up to reality, I couldn't go back to the dream. But Jude was still able to hold out hope in his heart that it would be there waiting for him when he was ready to return. After everything, he still believed that the league could be different, better, healed. I wasn't out of shape by any means, but hiking over hill after hill, fighting through the thick mulch of newly dead leaves on an empty stomach, all the while trying to keep my brain from circling back to Liam, was beginning to weigh on me. Jude's stomach had growled no less than 4 times in the past half hour alone, and while he seemed immune to getting cranky like the rest of us, I felt him start to sag next to me.
Almost there. I assured him, shooting a dirty look at the back of Brett's head. It wasn't his fault. We didn't have cars to transport everyone. There had been some discussion about trying to navigate down on the Cumberland River, but even months after the flooding, Brett felt like its current was too unstable for their rafts. So we were walking, using fabric cut from the tents as makeshift bags for the supplies. We were walking 10 miles, 11, 12. My fingers were frozen stiff. Not even pressing them up under my armpits could get the blood flowing back through them. Jude pursed his lips together, reaching up to adjust his cap. With it pressing down at such an awkward angle over his curly hair, it bent his ears out, making them look bigger than they actually were. For a bizarre second, I felt my heart swell just the smallest bit at the sight.
"Anyway," said Jude, master of awkward transitions. "This is going to be so great. So, so great. We'll be in like this," he snapped his fingers, "swipe the meds and some food and out, like bam."
He clenched both fists and flashed his fingers out.
"They won't even know we've been there until we're gone. We'll be freaking legends."
Jude kept saying they this and they that, but that was the problem. We didn't know who was in charge of the airport or why they were hoarding supplies. I tried to send a follow-up message to Kate and Nico to ask, but they hadn't responded before we left. We were still heading east, toward Nashville's center, but the river didn't follow a straight path. It had looped down again, directly in front of us. I nudged my way up to the front of the group. My outstretched hand eventually found Olivia's shoulder, and she reached back, pulling me to the edge of the Cumberland River.
"Whoa,"
was Jude's only comment. Until we hit that first barrier, I hadn't really understood why, months after the floodwaters receded, the city was still closed. But it was like with any disasters. The cleanup was almost always worse than the stress of the disaster in progress. No wonder the ground had become little more than a swamp under my boots. No wonder the river was still flooding out. The initial storms had been powerful enough to carry whole sections of homes back into the river, to upend massive river barges and leave them stranded and rusting under the sun. It was like a terrible drain clog. The water couldn't flow naturally down toward the city, which meant it was still bleeding out into the nearby fields and forests.
"It's right over there," Brett said,
pointing to distant white shapes. As if on cue, a red light on one of them began to pulse, slow and steady.
"Nice to see Gray and his boys got around to cleaning this mess up like he swore he would."
"Are we swimming?" I asked, trying not to grimace. Olivia turned toward me, holding up our one lone flashlight. The scarred half of her face stretched into a genuine smile.
"Nope. We're going to play leapfrog."
It turned out that playing leapfrog with a bunch of blues essentially meant resigning yourself to being flung from floating object to floating object like a rag doll. The system they'd worked through was impressive. The river was too wide for the blues to lift another kid with their abilities and send him cruising the whole way across it. Instead, Brett took advantage of the flood's wreckage, lifting Olivia and setting her down, with impressive accuracy and care, on the upturned corner of a half-sunk barge. She, in turn, sent the next blue a little farther, onto the roof of what looked like a large mobile home. With the three of them in position, they were able to pass each of us along without much trouble at all. I landed on my knees, finally, on the other bank. We cut another path through a thicket of trees, emerging muddy and slick with the fresh rain falling overhead. The runway was shorter than the ones I'd seen at bigger airports, jam-packed with planes of all sizes and shapes. Mixed in between the helicopters and one-seaters were green and tan military vehicles. The airport wasn't in use after all, then. And if the planes and trucks were out here, it meant there really was a good chance that Kate and Nico's intel was good, and something else was being stored in the hangars. Someone, the National Guard by the look of the vehicles, had half-heartedly put up a chain-link fence around the perimeter of the runways and hangars, along with signs that read things like, "No trespassing" and "High voltage."
Olivia threw a rock, which bounced back and hit the mud with the tiniest rattle. Jude twisted out of the grip I had on his shirt to belly crawl through the grass.
"Hey,"
I whispered,
"Jude."
He tapped the fence with his finger, then again for good measure before he hustled back over to us.
"That has about as much electricity as my shoe,"
he whispered. This isn't right, I thought. If there was something worth having here, there'd be people to protect it, right? I scanned the field in front of us again, Instructor March's voice ringing in my ears. If it looks too good, too easy, it never is. And the simulation we'd run after, with Vida and I storming a warehouse, had proven that point. Sure, it had been all clear on the outside. The agents playing the roles of the National Guardsmen had been waiting for us inside.
"Rue," Jude groaned. "Come on."
There was no real cover between the trees and the hangars, but that didn't stop Brett and some of the others from blowing past us to continue forward. Even Olivia looked over at me, exasperated, before she stood and jogged to catch up to them.
"All right," I told Jude. "Stay close."
But he was already up and running, too, weaving through the vehicles and planes on the runway. I finally caught up with them when they stopped at the edge of the asphalt, crouching down behind the last line of vehicles.
"I'll take Brett and Jude with me,"
I said, taking the flashlight from Olivia. "Two flashes for all clear, one for turn back. Got it?"
"There's no one here, Ruby."
"And that doesn't strike you as odd?" I hissed back. There were tire tracks and footprints all around us. If they were old, they would have been washed out after days of rain. The nearby parking lots were mostly empty or filled with large shipping trucks. Now and then a light above them would flicker, but aside from that, the airport was dark. Every nerve in my body was tingling by the time I met up with Brett again after we'd lapped the buildings. I jerked my chin back in the direction where we'd left Jude waiting.
"This is too easy," Brett finally admitted, shifting his old rifle to his shoulder. "Where the hell is everyone?"
"Please, not in the hangars," I thought. "Please." This was my idea. I'd pushed them into this, and it would be on me to get us out if everything blew up in our faces. Kate wouldn't have sent us here if she thought it was too dangerous, I told myself. Not if there was a chance we could be caught. "Call the others over," I told Jude, silencing the small voice before it could send me spiraling into true fear. I counted them again as they ran toward us. 1, 2, 3, all the way up to 21. The hunting party shrank into the shadow of Hangar 1, backs pressed to the wall, eyes scanning the dark field. The hangar door was locked with a series of imposing chains we had no way of slicing through, but there was a side access door that, like I'd predicted, had some kind of electronic lock that looked like it had been beamed back from the distant future.
"Step aside," Jude said, shooing me away with his hands. "The master is here."
"Careful," I warned. "Frying it completely will probably trigger it, too."
"Honestly,"
he said, squinting at the display. It lit instinctively when he stepped in front of it, pulling up a digital number pad.
"You're acting like I've never done this before."
"You haven't," I reminded him. "Nico usually disables the alarm systems remotely."
"Details, details."
Jude waved me off with one hand and brought his other palm up against the screen.
"Be silent so the master can do his work."
"Can the master hurry the hell up?"
Brett hissed, hopping from foot to foot, arms crossed over his chest. I was starting to feel the winter bite, too. The sweat gliding down my face felt like it was 2 degrees away from freezing into solid crystals.
"Count of three,"
Jude breathed out.
"Push on the door handle. Ready?"
I slipped around him, getting a good grip on the metal bar.
"Go for it."
At three, the system screen flickered black, and I waited only long enough to hear the lock pop before shoving it open with my shoulder. When the system's number pad flashed back up, it cast an eerie red halo on the drifting snowflakes. I waited for the shrill cry of an alarm, the blinding flash of floodlights spotlighting our small group. I waited to feel Jude shrink against the wall behind me in terror. I waited,
waited. But there was nothing to wait for.
Okay, Jude called. I tricked the system into thinking that the door is actually closed. We just have to keep it open, and then we won't run into any problems.
Nice job, I whispered. The others streamed in past us, leaving a trail of mud and slush on the concrete ramp. We smelled like wet dogs that had rolled around in an ashtray. Jude grinned as he dashed in after them. Someone hit the overhead lights and flooded the room with pristine white. I covered my eyes with a hand, trying to adjust to the glare. There was a strange charge to the air now. I felt Jude's mood shift from a sparkling excitement to the kind of shock that only ever comes like a brick to the face. The shift was so fast and so sudden that I was almost too afraid to see the hangar for myself.
Holy shit!
There were rows of metal shelves lining the echoing room. They'd been set up almost like the stacks in a library, but had to be a good 2 or 3 times the normal size. The soldiers had dragged them into tight, neat rows. The thick layer of faint peach paint someone had coated the cement with still had the gouges and scuff marks to prove it. Stacked on top of them were pallets and pyramids of boxes. Many were unlabeled, even more wrapped up tightly in a nest of clear plastic.
"What language is that?" Olivia asked.
She kicked at the nearest one, knocking the dust and clumps of dirt from it with the toe of her boot. It was buckled on one side, the thin wood cracking as if it had fallen from a great height and landed wrong side up in a field.
"Chinese?" Jude guessed. "Japanese? Korean?"
I didn't recognize the words printed there, but the simple red cross that had been stamped over it, that I did recognize. The American Red Cross branches had, if you believed the news, run out of funds and supplies once all shipping to and from the United States was halted. People were afraid that IAAN was contagious and could jump ship, riding shotgun on a package or in a person, to go plague another healthier country. Once the economy was gone, the organization barely had funding to stay afloat for 2 more years. So what the hell was this stuff?
"Liv, check it out!"
one of the guys called. He and a few of the others had sliced through the plastic and were levitating boxes down to the ground from the upper shelves. One of them was already gutted, its fire engine red innards sliding across the floor. I picked up one of the red packages that had spilled out, surprised by its weight and rectangular shape. There was a sketch of a man lifting food to his mouth and a flag, both printed under the words, "Humanitarian Daily Ration."
"This bag contains 1 day's complete food requirement for 1 person, Olivia read.
There were more lines beneath it, in French and Spanish, maybe. "Food gift from the people of China," I finished, passing the package back to her. There were several sharp intakes of breath around us, but most of the others had been driven onto the next shelf, pulling down cardboard boxes printed with 10 24-hours ration, GP NATO / OTAN approved.
"This stuff is from the UK, I think."
Jude had ripped into one of the boxes and was examining a pamphlet that had been left inside.
There's so much stuff. Matches, soup, chocolate. Oh my God, there's even tea.
"Take what we need," I said, "but look for the medicine. Do you see any of it?"
"This stuff is from Russia,"
I heard Brett call from the next aisle over.
"Here's Germany, Canada, and I think Japan," Olivia called back. "France and Italy, too," came another voice. "They all say daily rations."
I slipped out the thin piece of notebook paper Chubbs had scribbled his list on, holding it up to catch the light. His handwriting was as dark and smudged as ever. Whatever pen he'd managed to dig up out of the supply pile had started sputtering ink when he hit penicillin. He branched out all of the different kinds beneath that word. Amoxicillin, amoxil, ampicillin, rimacillin, benzylpenicillin, Cristapen. I jogged down the aisle scanning the boxes and crates with wary eyes. More food, trash bags of what looked like wool blankets all boxed up, all stamped with flags I didn't recognize. There were red crosses everywhere, on everything. Dirt and clumps of dead grass clung to their edges. It had all been outside once, I realized, dropped by planes passing overhead, maybe? Kate had mentioned rumors of foreign aid being left in parts of the country, but those same rumors had died out when no one turned up any evidence to prove it.
1 minute!
My heart jumped from my ribs to the back of my throat. The air whistling in between my teeth sounded loud to my ears. It was quieter back here under the towering plastic tubs that were stacked against the hangar's back wall. I leaned down, brushing away the dust from its clear side. More of those strange red packages. I moved onto the next tub, half listening to the anxious whispers carrying over from the other side of the hangar. I didn't stop searching. Not until my eyes drifted over the familiar curved neck of Lita Corp's golden swan. Chubbs's list fluttered to the ground as I stood on my toes, trying to see what was inside of this one. Lita Corp meant medicine. My experiences riding in the back of cargo planes had taught me that much. I got as good of a grip as I could on the plastic lid and began to yank it out. Jude was calling for me, his voice drifting above the others. "Come on, come on!" I grumbled, my arms shaking with the effort. The tub exploded open as it hit the ground. I dug into the clear packets of vials and sterile needles until I recognized one of the penicillin names that Chubbs had written down. I took as many as I could, scooping them into my bag. Another tub was labeled vaccines, but the one below it had wound up ribbons of gauze, cotton pads, and rubbing alcohol.
"A little help over here!"
I called. One of my bags was already full, and the second one was quickly going the same way. We needed more. Liam needed more. Footsteps fell fast and heavy on the cement. I felt someone rush behind me, muttering something under his breath that I didn't quite catch. One glance over my shoulder told me that half of the group, struggling under the new weight of their packs, was doing one last loop through the different aisles.
"Ruby?"
It wasn't the crack in Jude's voice that sent me spinning back. It was the sudden, overwhelming stench of stale cigarette smoke. I wasn't fast enough. I shifted, meaning to throw up an arm to block the blow, but the knife found me a moment before the punch to the back of the head did. I don't know if I screamed. My jaw dropped with a burst of pain. I tried to catch myself as I pitched forward into the tubs, but a hand fisted around my ponytail and wrenched me back. I didn't have a chance to regain my balance. The gun was ripped out from the back of my pants before I could think clearly enough to pull it. Michael was breathing ragged and uneven, more with fury, I thought, than the effort of the attack. The knife, or whatever he'd used, twisted in my lower back, and that time I knew I screamed. The arm across my chest slid up to press against my throat, my gun fisted tight in his hand. He pressed it up under my chin, forcing it as high as the bones in my neck would allow without snapping. I couldn't breathe, couldn't swallow, couldn't move.
"Miss me?" he hissed.
I tried throwing my head back, twisting, anything to get away. "You're okay," I told myself. "Not your spine, not your kidney, just..."
"Thanks for finding this place,"
he continued, slamming me forward against the tubs. Michael leaned down low, bringing his lips up to my ear.
"You and the others can get your sweet fill until the PSFs get here, yeah?"
The force of Jude ramming into us shoulder first wasn't enough to throw Michael off me completely, but it was powerful enough that I could turn and drive my knee up into his center. I heard the knife give way from my skin with a sucking sound and clatter against the floor. Jude's mop of curling hair dove for it at the same time Michael did. My entire right side screamed in pain as my foot went flying toward his face.
"Bitch!"
he screamed, and then I was flying back, slamming into the shelves opposite us. Jude was sent flying in another direction, back toward Brett and Olivia, who were coming down the aisle to see what was happening. One shot fired. Another one. And the lights changed from white to a flashing red, and everything after was swallowed by a pulsing screech. 20. I don't know how I got from the back of the hangar to the front, only that when the black fuzz lifted from my brain and the nauseating brightness of the overhead lights warmed to an unbearable glow, Jude had me propped up at one shoulder, Olivia at the other, and we were watching as Michael and four others collected our guns and sacks of food rations.
To the right of them, shaking like the last leaf on an autumn tree, was a blank-stared Knox. So that was where Michael and the others had gone, to find their old pack leader. A lot of good it seemed like it was doing for them now, though. Knox muttered to himself, rocking back and forth on his heels, the same word forming on his lips. Leave. Leave. Leave.
Your choice, Michael shouted.
The noise had cut out, but not the flashing lights.
You chose strangers over Knox, over me. You want to take everything from us and kick us out? We found that damn warehouse. We set everything up.
Jude was shaking, not from fear or the cold, but from blistering anger.
So, if you can't have it, no one can? Is that it?
He said, his hand tightening around my waist.
You hate your life, so you have to make everyone else just as miserable and hungry and pathetic as you are? I am not pathetic. None of us are. If she hadn't messed him up, Knox would be telling you this. Look at him. Look. You want her to do this to you? You want another performance of her freak show?
Believe me. I shook my head in a weak attempt to clear the spots from my vision. If you don't drop those bags and get the hell out of my sight in 2 seconds, you'll be next. He raised his gun, but Olivia and Brett both stepped directly in front of me. There was a quick movement to my left. I looked over just in time to see one of Michael's team yank the door to open it again. One of them must have shut it, I realized. That's why the alarms had gone off in the first place.
Time to go, the boy shouted. They're pulling up.
My core settled to stone. If they were here, it was already too late.
Don't,
Brett warned, but Michael grabbed Knox and followed the others out into the night anyway. There were 2 beats of silence. I closed my eyes and turned away from the shouting, the whining of cars and guns and uniforms. 1 shot was fired. 100 answered.
Down,
I commanded, tackling Jude. For the most part, the bullets pinged off the large hangar door, just to the right of the smaller side access door we'd come through. But some passed through the thin metal and buried themselves in the same shelves of supplies we had just ransacked. My mind was fraying at the edges, a pounding headache echoing every throb of pain in my lower back. I swiped at the sweat beating on my upper lip. I didn't need to get up with Brett or find a way to look outside. I knew what I'd see. 4 dumb, dead kids and a swarm of black and camo setting up a line of defense.
I count 30 of them,
one of the blues said. I don't even know your name, I thought numbly, and you followed us here anyway. I am going to get you killed. I felt the overpowering urge to throw up as I stood. We are dead. I killed us.
This'll be cake, right?
Brett said, clearing his throat. He turned back to the others. They got guns, but we got brains. I like those odds.
1 big push should do it, Olivia agreed. I can take half back over the river the way we came, but someone else should try to take the other half the long way.
Brett rubbed a hand through his dark hair with a light laugh.
By someone, you mean me? That eager to get rid of me?
The blues were dividing themselves up, falling in place behind Olivia and Brett, and the absurdity of what we were about to do, shove them like playground bullies, then try to outrun the bullets that followed, made me want to scream. I stood at the edge of the noise and movement, feeling strangely disconnected from what was going on around me. But Jude, he cut right through the panic, shoving his way through the bodies to reach the fuse box on the wall.
Everyone, line up at the door,
he said, smashing the small lock on the electrical box with a nearby fire extinguisher. He tossed the broken metal behind him and pulled the gray cover open. Jude bit the tip of his right glove and pulled it back off, placing his bare hand against the assortment of switches. The dials at the top began to spin at a crazy speed, their tiny red arms blurring.
You guys throw them back, and I'll follow up with a punch.
He sounded calm, way too calm for him. What are you doing? I asked. The air felt warmer, tickling my face. The mop of chestnut hair in front of me started to rise and crackle with static. I took a step back, but it wasn't until the light snapped off and the alarm went dead that I could see the blue lines of sparks racing along his hands and arms.
"Ruby, you have to hit the button for the door," he said.
Just standing close to him made the hair on my arms rise.
"What are you doing?"
I asked again. He seemed to be splitting into two in front of my eyes. I blinked, but the halo of light around him didn't vanish with it.
"Trust me,"
he said, his voice carrying that unnatural calmness.
"I got this one."
He counted down from three, forcing the blues to scramble into the line he had ordered. Jude took care not to touch anyone at the very center of the line. The others seemed to curve around him, responding to his charge and the shift in mood.
"No,"
I thought, biting the word back.
"No, not there. Not where they can hurt you."
"One!"
Jude's voice rang out. My hand slapped against the button. The snow had changed to a heavy rain while we were inside. It fell in sheets, distorting the lights the soldiers had set up. The white beams flooded in at our feet and traveled upward over our legs as the enormous door continued to rise. Jude waited until the light hit him square in the chest, and then he clenched both fists. They weren't floodlights, I realized, just the headlights of the four trucks that had parked in a half ring around the hangar's door. Most of the soldiers had taken up behind the green vehicles, bracing their guns over the hoods for a steadier aim. A good 24 soldiers knelt on the ground in front of them, rifles raised, helmets strapped on. The door came to a screeching stop overhead. A few of the soldiers in camo sat back on their heels or pulled back from the sights of their guns, surprised, I'm sure, to see nothing but a small cluster of freaks. One of the men in front turned and shouted something back to the others, but the rain swallowed his words. A burst of whining static cut in. Someone had retrieved a megaphone for one of the older men in the back.
"You are to come with us," he said, "on authority of the Psi Special Forces Commander Joseph Traylor. If you do not cooperate, we will respond with force."
"Yeah," Brett called. "You can tell Joseph Traylor that, on our authority, he can suck it."
That was the cue, whether he had meant it to be or not. The Blues took one single step forward and threw up their arms. Even the soldiers who recognized what was happening were too slow to fully respond. The pop, pop, pop of an automatic weapon was swallowed by the startled screams as the whole cluster of the soldiers and their trucks were lifted and thrown back, as if by an invisible tidal wave. And then Jude stepped out into the rain. It was both horrible and beautiful to watch. Familiar, somehow, to see the roaring electricity he had collected from the hangar hover around him like a blue sun. The light swelled out, bursting past the walls of his skin, and raced out along the pooled rainwater on the pavement in rivers of searing light. Jude's shape became a shadow, a simple silhouette, as the electricity billowed out in front of him, growing like a silent, blinding explosion. The night lost the fresh smell of rain, carrying a new stench of burned skin and hair, and the unmistakable gut-churning odor of white-hot rubber instead. The electricity sizzled as it lashed out. It jumped up past the rubber-soled boots. It lit clothes and bones and skin, heating the metal canisters of pepper spray until they exploded. The soldiers that hadn't been knocked out by the Blues hit began to writhe on the ground. One managed to lift his gun, aiming in the general direction of Jude, only to be shoved farther back by Brett. Jude stayed on his feet as long as he could, shaking and trembling like a wet rabbit in the blistering cold. Then he collapsed, knees to pavement, chest to pavement, face to pavement, in such a boneless way that I screamed, pushing past the others to get to him. I flipped him over onto his back, ignoring the sharp pricks of static stabbing my fingers. His face felt burning to the touch, even under a blanket of freezing rain. When he had fallen, so had the charge, the popping blue rivets of electricity evaporating like steam. Olivia's group came out next, scrambling for whatever guns they could reach,
kicking aside prone soldiers to get to them.
Olivia!
Brett shouted. I looked up as he and the others came rushing out after the first group. She stopped, her feet sliding against the pavement as she turned. He had one hand around her upper arm, another in her loose braid. He drew his face down to her scarred one and kissed her. It lasted no longer than a heartbeat, a firm, exact message.
Now run,
he said, pushing her toward the others. I struggled under Jude's awkward length, trying to lift his prone form. Brett shoulder-checked me aside, not having the patience or, clearly, the time to waste on trying to rouse the kid out of his exhausted stupor. He hoisted Jude up onto his back. The pack he had carried out was kicked to another blue, who scooped it up mid-stride.
This way, he called.
The running was so much worse, so much harder than I expected. Car engines came rip-roaring alive behind us. I saw more speeding down the nearby road, but only the last two in that caravan saw us quickly enough to turn off into the field before entering the small airport. The headlights bounced as the SUVs took each hill and pit. The trees, though, the trees were up ahead, their dark, thick line lit. A hand closed around my wrist, wrenching me back. I fell hard, my feet slipping out from under me with a combination of mud and frost and ice. An explosion of gray spots bloomed behind my eyelids as my head slammed back against the ground. The soldier shined a flashlight in my face, close enough to my eyes that I had to shut them again to escape the brightness. Her knee came down on my chest and pushed that last breath of air out of it. I twisted and kicked, a frustrated scream ripping out of my throat. Then the light dropped away, and I could open my eyes again. She was young, but more importantly, she was furious. The soldier tugged an orange object off her belt and held it directly in front of my face. She shouted something I couldn't hear. The rain. It was only rain, filling my mouth, my nose, my eyes, my ears. The orange device swam in my vision again, disappearing in another burst of white light. I knew the moment the device pulled up my profile. The PSF's face went slack with horror, her eyes drifting back down to my face. I turned my head and sunk my teeth into her wrist's burned pink flesh. She shrieked, but I was already in her mind. A car's bright headlight slashed through the dark, highlighting the shapes running toward us, heading into the woods.
Get off!
I kicked one last time, with enough force that even Instructor Johnson would have approved. The soldier slumped off me, landing hard in the dirt. Her eyes were open and vacant, staring at me, waiting for an order. I didn't bother unhooking my mind's claws from her. I didn't care. Every part of my body felt slow and heavy. It took all my focus to get to the trees without falling, and more than even that, to haul my limbs through the crunching underbrush and ice. The land was rising. Every hill seemed to set me back from the pack that much farther. I ran, or I tried to. I tried everything I could to push myself past the haze settling over my mind and the trembling that started in my legs and rose steadily with each drop in the landscape. I thought of Liam, of Chubbs, of Vida, of Jude. We had to get back and tell the others. We had to move them in case any of the soldiers traced our path.
Jude,
I mumbled, my foot slipping out from under me. Something boiling hot raced down over my hip.
Jude. Vida. Chubbs. Liam. Jude.
Brett had taken him, hadn't he? If he could navigate through the twisted tree branches with the kid's full weight on his back, I could do this. I could stand back up. You did this. We were done. They would take us and I would never see any of them again. I breathed out their names until there was no air in my chest. I walked until my legs disappeared from under me. I watched as the last trace of the kids up ahead faded at the crest of a hill, bleeding into the deep dark of the woods. I didn't remember falling, only the sensation that I had somehow lost half my body and left it behind under the cover of the trees. I pushed myself onto my back, my hand flopping around my waist, looking for a gun that wasn't there. Accept. Adapt. Act. With a sob of pain, I hauled myself back up against a tree trunk, propping my back up. I'd be able to see anyone coming. I could rest now. I could look up through the bare bones of the old trees around me and watch the rain tear the sky down piece by piece until there was nothing left but darkness. 21. I was born in the dark heart of a fierce winter. My parents and my Gram's words, not mine. She and Dad loved to pull out the story of the death-defying trip home from the hospital when I wouldn't settle down at night, or I got fidgety and bored at family dinners. The blizzard got me every time. I'd let myself be wrapped up in the way their words seemed to drip with danger, how they used their hands to try to show how high the snow rose. I could barely keep up. Each time I tried to absorb every word, take the words in so deep I'd dream about them when I finally fell asleep. Now there was just an overwhelming sense of embarrassment. I hated how stupid I'd been to think that surviving it meant I was somehow special. That I ever thought it was undeniable proof there was something I was supposed to live to do later. The sky was the color of ash, Dad would say. And the minute I left the parking lot, the clouds seemed to drop. I should have turned back right away, but your mom wanted to get home to Graham's. She was throwing a whole welcome home shindig for us, you know. They had made it as far as they could, Dad in the driver's seat trying to force his way through a suffocating curtain of white, Mom in the back seat with me, yelling at him to pull over before he drove us off some non-existent cliff. He liked telling that part of the story best. Dad was the only one who could nail the high, breathy quality that Mom's voice got when she was hovering at the edge of a meltdown. The car's headlights were no match for the snow, but there were still people fighting to get down that stretch of highway. Dad did pull over, but someone coming from the complete opposite direction jumped lanes and smashed into the front of our car. I don't know where they were going or why they were speeding blindly through high winds and no visibility, but they totaled our car, forcing us off the shoulder and into an ever-building snowbank. They killed the engine and the battery. There was no cell phone reception. They couldn't even pick up the radio. Mom always told that part of the story in a tight voice, her imagination fixed on everything that could have happened to us if the storm had gone on much longer than it did. The three of us huddled in the back seat together for 3 hours, trying not to panic, pressing together for warmth. I slept through the whole thing. I think Graham's liked the story because she got to play the hero. She'd mobilized the neighbors into a search party and used her truck to haul my parents' car back onto the highway. "It's just life for you, little bee," she told me years later. "Sometimes you're the one speeding along in a panic, doing too much, not paying attention, wrecking things you don't mean to. And sometimes life just happens to you, and you can't dodge it. It crashes into you because it wants to see what you're made of." Despite how terrifying the story was to me as a kid, I still loved winter growing up. The cold didn't bother me, because I knew that in the span of months, weeks, days, the season would change again. It's easy to ride out the coldest of days with nothing more than that promise and the warmth of the people around you. But this chill, the one I felt now, sank down to my bones. It was a numbness that wasn't about to be shaken off. There was no escaping it. The ground slid under my back, patches of mud gave way to ice, and then again to rocks that dug into my tailbone and ripped up the length of my spine. I heard the crackle of frost-bitten leaves as they passed by my ears, felt the sharp tugging as my hair caught on something. One hand tried to close around a passing root, to anchor myself against the river of dirt, but I was moving too quickly. The sun flashed red behind my eyelids, stabbing through the pounding pain inside my skull. I couldn't feel my right leg. I actually couldn't feel much of anything on my right side. It wasn't until the light receded and I could open my eyes that my mind finally made the connection that I was moving, not the ground. The sky overhead was blue behind the patches of towering white clouds. I could just make it out through the naked gray arms of the trees. I drew my brows together, taking in the sharp stink of body odor.
There was a grunt of effort as a large, rough surface passed under my back. Then it was smooth earth, a dip that came quickly without warning, like the initial dive of a descending airplane. My stomach and eyes shifted down. The man wore a deep red puffer jacket, one that had been worn and frayed by the decades. The hem by his hip was torn, the white stuffing pushing through the hole. His jeans were too tight. They protested every time he turned to get a better grip on my leg.
Don't.
My voice was gone. I tried to bring my other leg up to kick his grip off, but none of my limbs were responding. The man must have felt me strain, because he glanced back over his shoulder.
Awake, are you?
I was seeing two of him, then three, then four. Focus, I ordered myself. The guy looked about as threatening as a mall Santa. He wore his beard long and patchy, but the gut was there. Dad used to read me books that talked about the twinkle in Santa's eye and his rosy red cheeks. Well, this one's eyes were glinting all right, with dollar signs.
Try anything funny and I'll snap that neck of yours. You hear me?
Move. I tried to lift my hips. Instructor Johnson had taught me how to break out of a hold like this several times over. I tried feeling for a rock I could throw at the tender spot where the base of his skull met his neck, for the Swiss Army knife that was no longer stashed in my boot. My body wasn't responding. I had hit my head. Not that hard, right? The night before was cast in shadow. I remembered the long walk, Jude resetting the security system, all of those boxes and crates stamped with flags and strange languages. And Knox. Knox had been there, hadn't he? The headache exploded behind my eyes, and I squeezed them shut again. The sun was shining. Why was I so, so cold?
There's someone here who'll be super interested in meeting you, the man continued. Came nosing around this morning asking questions about whether or not we'd seen any kids. Said there was a big bust up by the air park. A few might have gotten away. And I thought to myself, Joe Hiddle, this man could be crazy, or he could be right. So I went out hunting, like usual, and what do I find?
I dropped my hips, trying to create as much drag as possible going down the next hill. Maybe I couldn't fight back, but I wasn't going to make it easy on him.
What?
He began, twisting my ankle at an unnatural angle.
Did I just say?
I used what little mobility I had in my neck to crane it forward as we came down that last hill. Tents, more than I had even seen back at the warehouse. Most were white or printed with the words, Property of the U.S. Army. A jolt of terror went through me, powering one solid kick to the back of the man's kneecap. The burst of pain that ripped down my right side was nothing compared to the man kicking me square in the ribs. I went quietly because I had to. That barest hint of energy I had felt dripped out of me, and I could almost imagine it trailing behind us like a smear of blood.
Sandra!
The man shouted.
Sandy! That guy's still here?
There were feet and faces around us from the moment we entered the line of tents. The smells here came in bursts. Smoked meat, dirty laundry, stale water. It was all mud around the entrances of the tents, but inside were rugs and candles and piles of old mattresses and bedding.
Joe, is that...
Someone began.
Back off, Ava, Joe warned. I found her. Sandra! He did live,
came another woman's voice, her accent almost undecipherable.
I'll go see if your truck is still on the highway. You just keep that in here.
My sweatshirt had pulled up in the back, and the mud there felt as slimy as it was freezing. Something, someone, touched my left hand with the side of his foot.
Is that kid?
A middle-aged woman's flushed face leaned down close over mine. She pulled one of her mismatched gloves off and started to put the back of her hand to my forehead. Joe all but growled at her, forcing her back a step. My eyes drifted shut again, and by the time I had worked them open, there were other faces in place of hers. It was a gallery wall of unrestrained emotions, portraits of weary fear, landscapes of sadness, miniatures of curiosity.
I tried shifting again, but I couldn't ease the gripping pain in my head.
"She's shaking," one of the men said. I saw his yellowing Nikes, not his face.
"Let me get her a blanket." "Is she sick? She's so pale."
A woman this time.
"God, she can't be older than 16. Look at her, Joe. You're going to give her to that man."
Here's the thing about guns. They were like the talking stick my first grade teacher used to pass around during class. Whoever held it was the only one allowed to speak.
"Get back to your damn tents!"
Joe's gun was a shiny silver revolver, and no one was willing to test to see how many bullets were left in the cylinder. A woman, Sandra, let out a shriek of,
"Here he is! Here he is!"
And it was carried straight to us by the wind. The unmistakable sound of a car engine followed, the growl of its engine louder and louder as it drove around the sunken perimeter of the tent city. I licked my chapped lips, trying to drag in a deep breath that wouldn't come. This man, whoever he was like a stone thrown into a lake of still water. Even the people who had questioned Joe scattered. My leg was dropped back to the ground. The blood that rushed back into it felt like it was filled with glass.
"And my money?" Joe was saying. "I want to know how I'm getting reimbursed by Gray. He sure as shit didn't do anything when the river took everything I owned."
"Your name goes into the skip tracer system. They find you. I'm just transport. Hold her there, will you?"
The fog ripped back from my brain. A foot came down on my wrist, pinning me.
"No!"
I choked out, eyes searching the tent fronts for a sympathetic face, an indecisive one. Anyone who wasn't Rob Meadows. They watched. All of them. Every single person in that tent city. Their anxiety pawed at the air and stirred in my mind. But their silence, that was deafening. Opening my eyes again would make it real, but that was the way he wanted it. His hand fisted in whatever was left of my ponytail, tightening and wrenching my head back to get a better look at me. He smiled.
"Hiya, Jem," Rob snarled. "Been a while."
I choked on the word no.
"Here."
Rob absently shoved a tablet toward the man. "Type in your name and social security number. Reward is split 60-40.
60-40?
Joe sputtered.
"That's holy God! That figures, right? How much?"
Someone shouted from down the way.
"Don't forget I let you borrow my gun. You owe me for last month's rations."
"Hold her," Rob barked. "She needs proper restraints."
My hands were drawn together and kept there, not by plastic, but by the press of metal. I heard the chain rattle and felt him lift my head, sucked in the scent of leather. I screamed. It was a ragged, ugly noise that shattered my throat.
"No,"
I begged, tossing my head, twisting my neck to get away. Rob's knees dropped onto my chest, and my next breath came out as a sob.
"Oh, yeah. You remember this, don't you?"
"No,"
I sobbed.
"Please."
In the end, all of that training came to nothing. I could shift and cry and try to scream, but my ribs felt like they were caving in. The whole world was collapsing, crushing, and dissolving the faces of everyone who stood there watching. Rob snapped on a pair of thick rubber gloves before shoving the muzzle over my mouth and tightening the strap behind my head. And I was a little girl again. I was the monster of the story. My breath was hot, steaming. Joe passed the tablet to Rob and took several steps back. He looked at the white-haired woman to his right and said,
"God, if I'd known, I wouldn't have touched the thing at all."
Rob bent and tried to haul me out of the mud by the chain that connected the handcuffs to the muzzle. I got no farther than my knees. The rest of my body still hadn't solidified under me. With an ear-scorching curse and a grunt of disgust, he picked me up and carried me under one arm, letting my feet drag and bounce along the ground. I reared back, trying to knock my head against the knots of muscles in his arm, but he only chuckled.
"I don't always get the world," he said, "but sometimes it treats me right. That look on your face when you saw me, I tell you, that was something else."
I twisted as he dragged me up into the back of his old red Jeep.
"I knew if I watched the Skip Tracer network, you'd screw up eventually. I get to ask you myself about the real reason you dodged out of the op. What Cole and Kate have to do with it. I wanted to be the one to pick you up, to drive you straight back to that little camp of yours and watch them drag you in.
I screamed into the leather, kicking at the back of the seat.
You and me? He said, pulling a long strip of plastic from the backpack he was wearing to bind my feet. I tried to kick, which earned me another laugh. We're gonna have such a fun trip back to West Virginia. I won't even ask for the reward.
The door slammed shut on my face, finally blocking me from the cluster of adults that stood in a single line in front of their homes, watching. The car rocked as he opened the driver's door and sat down.
You want to know why I killed those kids, bitch? He called back. They weren't fighters. None of you are. But you're the ones with all the power in the league these days. You get to overrun us, decide the ops, turn Albin into a worthless pile of cooing shit. But you don't understand. None of you does. You don't get what this world has to be if we're going to survive this. Even these skip tracers, they just don't understand that you're worth a lot more to this country dead than alive.
Rob was speeding despite the Jeep's shuddering protests, blasting ZZ goddamn top as loud as the stereo would go. He shouted back that he was tired of hearing me snivel and sob. What a coincidence. I was pretty damn tired of LaGrange and the smell of exhaust. I tried everything I could think of to get the muzzle off. The strap around the back of my head wouldn't budge. He'd tightened it to the point of pain, and, from the sound of it, had used a smaller plastic cable tie to reinforce it. I grunted, shifting to try to get to my boot. Something pulled at my lower back, and there was a feeling like a tear. I bit my lip, ignoring the warm flush of liquid soaking into my jeans. Michael. I'd forgotten about him getting the jump on me. No wonder it felt like I'd been dragged under a truck. I'd seen the blade. It had been small, about the size of the one on my Swiss Army knife. I needed to push through the pain, keep riding the adrenaline to keep from passing out again. The space was tight and almost too narrow to work, but I could be small when I wanted to be. I slid my fingers past the laces into the tight leather. I curled myself around my knees to better my reach before remembering that there was nothing to get. I'd never gotten my Swiss Army knife back. I hadn't been able to find it in the supplies. I swallowed hard. It's okay. It's okay. Don't panic. But I was. I could feel it bubbling up in my chest, and I knew if I let it get out of hand, it would suffocate me. You're okay. The song finally. Finally faded out.
Preparations for the Unity Summit are ongoing, came President Gray's eerily calm voice. I look forward to sitting with these men, many of whom I greatly respect, and...
Rob punched the station off.
It's funny, isn't it? He called back. That the president all of a sudden is that much more revolutionary than Albin? That he wants something new?
Yeah, I wanted to say. Hilarious. The guy had the misfortune of heading up an organization that had gone and grown itself another head, one with sharper teeth.
It took Albin forever to see what a mistake it was to bring you in, and he still sent you shitheads out to do the jobs any of us could have done. He can have his past, but he's not going to change my future.
I looked around, trying to find something potentially sharp enough to saw the plastic zip tie around my wrists.
And Connor? She just wanted to babysit you, but we got no time for that. We got no place for you here or anywhere. The only place for you is in those camps or buried with the rest of them. You hear me?
He was shouting now.
I don't need an excuse for what I did. I joined to get Gray out, not play house with a guy who's too damn scared to even go above ground. He thinks we joined up because of you? He wants to know why we can't respect you? But he won't let us use you for the one thing you're good for.
Dying for people like him, I thought. That's what he means.
I did what I had to do, and I'd do it again. I'll do it to every damn kid in the league until they get their heads straight again, and I'll start with your team.
Anger pulsed through me, warring with disgust. Keep it together, I commanded myself. He doesn't know. I didn't need to touch him. He could silence me, but Rob had no power over my mind.
What would Jude make of the electric fence at your old home, Ruby? He wondered aloud. What would the guards do to Vida when they saw just how pretty, just how built she is for a girl her age?